CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal.
Grandola Vila Morena, terra da fraternidade, o povo é quem mais ordena, dentro de ti ó cidade, dentro de ti ó cidade, o povo é quem mais ordena, terra da fraternidade, Grândola Vila Morena. Em cada esquina um amigo, em cada rosto igualdade, Grândola Vila Morena, terra da fraternidade, terra da fraternidade, Grândola Vila Morena. À sombra de uma azinheira que já não sabia a idade, jurei ter por companheira Grândola a tua vontade, Grândola a tua vontade, jurei ter por companheira à sombra de uma azinheira que já não sabia a idade.
Ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades, welcome back to Amandla. Today we have Uli Gierstad with us, and Uli has been a reliable and long-standing supporter and a provider of news stories and information. But this is now going to be a historical piece today. The song you just heard was Grândola Vila Morena, and it went out on the airwaves of Portuguese radio April 24th, 1974, just after midnight on that morning. And the point was that it was the rallying call for the young officers in the army who were forming a progressive force to overthrow the long-standing fascist dictatorship of Portugal. It had been more than 50 years, long before Hitler's rise or that of Mussolini. Portugal had fallen under the sway of a right-wing fascist dictatorship, and they were firmly committed to maintaining colonial rule in many cases around the world. If we look at Angola, Mozambique, Guinea-Bissau in Africa, Macau and East Timor in Portuguese Timor in the Indonesian area and China. So it finally happened that night when the call came, the army rose up en masse and went out to overthrow the dictatorship, and to their great joy and amazement, the population was totally behind them. It was it was such a wonderful event when one of the women in the crowd went up to a soldier and put a red carnation in the barrel of his gun. And at that point, the mood was set. This was a peaceful overthrow. Barely a shot was fired. The whole military and the population got behind the revolution. And within a year, the majority of African colonies were independent. And it was the end then of an important era of Portuguese colonialism that had started actually with the so-called voyages of exploration in the 1440s under Henry the Navigator, who started the whole process of going around Africa, not simply for trade and scientific discovery, as they said, but trade in slaves and gold and other things. So it ended as a result of this Portuguese uprising, and there was a very important event. Uli, maybe here's a point where you can come in and tell us what happened 2 weeks ago when in the news that you sent to us.
Yeah, I saw this obituary of a man called Otelo Sariba de Carvalho. And very soon, everybody knew him just as Otelo. He was an army captain. And as it was, he had been the leader, the real initiator of the armed forces movement, which was an organization loosely connected, secret, within the Portuguese armed forces of young officers. They secretly prepared a coup where they arrested the entire senior staff of the army, the air force, and the navy of the Portuguese army. They took the leadership, the political leadership. Antonio Caetano was the dictator, the fascist dictator, put them on a plane and shipped them off to Brazil, which was still ruled by a military government there. Now, Otelo was a mythical figure. He was a white settler. He was born in what was then the capital of Mozambique, the colonial capital of Mozambique, at that time called Lourenço Marques, of a very modest white settler family. At 19, with few options, he enrolled in the Portuguese army. And he served in Angola and then in Guinea-Bissau. This was in the very early 1960s. The armed, the real war against Portuguese colonialism began in 1961 in Angola. And very soon afterwards, it spread. Mozambique, Guinea-Bissau, 1963, Mozambique in 1964. And Portugal at that time was a poor, backwards country in the southwestern tip of Europe. And very soon after, the wars in Africa was bleeding the country, not only where soldiers by the hundreds, by within a few years, hundreds of soldiers every year were dying in these futile wars. And the Portuguese army was kept alive by support from NATO allies, the Germans, the Americans, and even the Canadians. So it was a futile war. The Portuguese economy, the people were fed up. The younger soldiers were very early on seeing that there was no future in this. As soon as the armed struggle in Africa started, it became obvious that the Portuguese colonial army, it was a foreign occupation army, like what we have seen in Afghanistan recently. And for the Mozambican population, the Angolan population, the African population, it was a war of neighbors versus neighbors, often of people who didn't belong there, who knew nothing of their countries and their societies, and was there simply to keep in place a system that kept them into backwardness. You know, Mozambique and Angola were settler colonies. There were 400,000 white Portuguese settlers in Angola, about 200,000 in Mozambique. That made the war longer and harder because they stood with the Portuguese army and made it a much more bitter war. But Otelo, having grown up in Mozambique, he could see this situation. He knew that it was a futile effort, that it was for nothing, and that the Portuguese population itself was turning against the war very quickly. But, you know, it was a dictatorship. There was no election. There was no open discussion. And that is why an underground movement formed in Portugal as well, allied with the liberation movements that began propaganda, began some acts of sabotage. And those were the people who, in the end, like the people who ran that radio station, knew what was going on, allied with the Portuguese young military officers, and started the coup on that night of 24th of April, 1974.
Could I ask you maybe to talk a little bit about this alliance between Otelo's forces and the liberation movements? What form did that alliance take? And would you describe Otelo as actively anti-colonial or anti-fascist, or both, or a Portuguese nationalist who thought that Portugal was just going to go down the tubes by maintaining its colonies?
I think for him, the futility of the wars became very evident. And also because he was in the forces and spent time in Portugal, in the mother country, he knew that the efforts of the war was keeping the country, Portugal, the mother country, into backwardness and fascist repression. And he could also see that the mood in the country itself was massively against the war. They knew that if they could get rid of, they meaning the young officers, they knew that they would get, if they could stage an effective operation and get rid of the army leadership, contain them, and the political leadership, ship them out of the country. I don't think there was any question ever of killing people. They did not want a bloodbath. And they knew that they would have immediate support from the vast majority of the population. And that is exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. Where it got uglier was in the colonies in Angola and in Mozambique, where the settler population immediately began to sabotage the whole decolonization process, which began after the coup. Because immediately after the coup, negotiations began. The junta of the young officers began to go, they stopped the war. Day one, they confined the colonial troops to the barracks and said there will be no more fighting. We are now looking for a way out of the war to give independence, whatever it may be, to the African colonies. And they sent emissaries, army officers, always to begin that process. But as I was saying, where it got ugly and violent was that, you know, the white settler population, big elements, not everybody, but big elements did not immediately leave, but they began to resist. And it turned into sometimes active sabotage, sometimes violence, burning of farms, ruining machinery, actively trying to wreak as much damage as they could on their way out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was in Angola and Mozambique at the end of this process. And it was nasty. It was clear that independence is what was going to happen in the colonies. But exactly how and how much damage would be done on the way, you know, we didn't know. As it was, in Guinea-Bissau. It went very quickly. Guinea-Bissau was not a settler colony. It's a humid, swampy, small countries. Most of the Portuguese who were sent there to administer, you know, died of malaria and tropical diseases. Nobody wanted to go to Guinea-Bissau. Angola was a beautiful country, productive country. There were big settler farms, industries, and people, the white settlers lived much better there than they would at home in Africa. And of course, the independence process in Angola ended with the civil war, mm-hmm. as the Portuguese managed to split the liberation movements, and it took a long time. In Mozambique, there was resistance to the process. There was some military action. Settlers occupied the radio stations where I ended up working a couple of years later, and tried to even detain the Portuguese military officers who came to negotiate. But in the end, the liberation movement in Mozambique, Frelimo, was too strong militarily and politically. So that took 15 months after the coup, Mozambique became an independent country. And Otelo was this mythical figure. He visited everywhere. He became a hero among the Africans and the Portuguese supporters at home. And of course, deeply hated by the forces of colonialism who tried to resist him. But he was very much there. Everybody just called him Otelo. You knew who he was. There were songs about him. He symbolized what had happened with the Carnation Revolution.
Was he supportive of Frelimo's vision for Mozambique, given that, you know, Frelimo, unlike a lot of other countries in Africa, had a more revolutionary and transformative program? Was he supportive of that vision?
I don't know if that could be seen immediately, or what. I don't know ideologically what his thinking was, or even that of most of his colleagues who led the revolution. But with Otelo later, after the colonies were independent, Portugal elected quite early on a social democratic government and began an integration into the European Union, and to get out of poverty, accepted the terms of what became the EU, and also fell under the structural reforms that the International Monetary Fund imposed on the population. And Otelo himself was firmly, strongly opposed to that, to the point that he himself joined what was a semi-clandestine leftist movement. And at one point, he tried to mobilize the armed forces, which he had left. He was then a civilian, to actually intervene in the government. And he was arrested and charged with sedition and sentenced to quite a lengthy prison terms. He was, when the Social Democratic Prime Minister was elected, Mario Soares, he pardoned Otelo quite quickly. I think he served about 5 or 6 years in prison. And after that, he had very little support in Portugal. He died. I don't think he did any much politics in the last 15 years of his life. He was 84 when he died 10 days ago.
Mm. Do you know if he ever made his way back to Mozambique?
After got out of prison, I don't know. Mm. I know he was there during the negotiations. I know he came during the early years of independence, even when I was working in Mozambique in the early 1980s. He was there, received by the president, Samora Machel, and others. Sometimes I wonder, of course, what he would have thought of Mozambique today, where things have gone in such a very different direction than what the vision was at the time. And we are back to actually a war in the northern part of the country.
Did he ever speak to what South Africa did to Mozambique in its efforts to undermine Frelimo and destroy the country's capacity to support the anti-apartheid movement? Do you know if he was attuned to that or concerned about it?
I am sure he and his colleagues were attuned to that. But Frelimo and the Mozambican government did not want the return of Portuguese military to the country. They really distanced themselves from any implication of the old colonial power. And I think for good reasons, because there were white settlers who were left and joined the government. There were civilian Portuguese who came to help with the administration and so on. In fact, many of them lived in the building where I lived with my family in Maputo. Most of them came maybe with good intentions, but had a very heavy colonial mindset. And whether they were the white saviors or really couldn't rid themselves of a complex, a deep in their DNA of superiority to Africans, often it didn't go well. And certainly there was a lot of tension around some of that. Now, there were other, white Portuguese who came and played a crucial role there, including the man who put that record on the night of the coup, who was also a white Mozambican who came right away after the coup, came back to Mozambique and became the director of Radio Mozambique.
What was his name?
His name was Leite de Vasconcelos. And Leite de Vasconcelos was a very modest guy. He never really wanted to talk about his contribution and the illegal work that he and his comrades had been doing in Portugal. He was a great guy to work for. Sometimes I made some mistakes, and the British embassy or the American embassy would complain. Some minister would come and say, who are these guys on the radio who are slandering our countries? And de Vasconcelos would call me into the office or my colleagues and say, is it true? Did you make a mistake? And then if we had done that, we would admit to it. And then he would say, it's all right. I'll handle it. I'll deal with these guys.
Doug, not hearing you.
I'm just going to get in here at this point because I lived in Malawi and the road from Blantyre to Lilongwe was in fact the border for a good stretch, and we often ran into the Portuguese army. And so I just wanted to reinforce how brutal wars of liberation, how the Portuguese responded to the wars of liberation in their Portuguese colonies. And we saw the troops, we saw the troop movements, and thousands of Mozambican fled to Malawi and other countries for refuge as a result of the war. And then in 1977, I visited Portugal for a week for an international conference it was 1 year commemoration of the Soweto Uprising. And I was absolutely amazed. I knew the history of Portuguese dictatorship. The repression in Europe was very heavy-handed, and it stood out in the European context for its being one of the last dictatorships of the sort on the continent. And the other impact that I had from getting there was arriving in the airport and hundreds of retornados, Portuguese fleeing the colony, still in 77, which is 3 years after the coup and 2 years after independence, sort of stateless people because they had lived so long elsewhere that they really didn't have roots and other documentation to guarantee their entry into Portugal. So there they were sitting in the airport waiting, and all the town squares were full of retornados getting together in the evenings. But the other thing that struck me was, after 50 years of very brutal dictatorship, was the vibrancy of political life in the first few years after the coup. The walls were plastered with posters from the communists and the socialists, and there was lots of still high spirits about what could be possible now that they had freed themselves of that. The country was, as Uli said, the poorest, most economically underdeveloped and poverty struck in Europe, and its wealth had been accumulated out of colonial exploitation almost exclusively, with very little development at home.
Yeah, so one of the retornados, Doug, they were returning by the tens of thousands.
Oh my gosh.
In the months and the years afterwards. My wife and I were on our way to Guinea-Bissau exactly 1 year after the Carnation Revolution, after the coup. And we were booked into a little hotel, a pensão, which was full of these retornados and their families. Often the spouses were Africans, the kids were mixed race. They were the most vile people I could imagine. On the second day of our arriving there, we woke up and there were combat aircraft, jet fighters flying over the rooftops of Lisbon. Our little hotel was shaking. We went up on the roof terrace and was full of retornados, and they were rubbing their hands and watching. And what was happening was that, fueled by this movement of return of all these colonial elements, there was an attempted counter coup, and the Air Force was attacking army barracks on hilltops across the city. And they were flying right over our head and firing rockets into this barracks. And of course, these retornados were hoping that their day had come. Revenge would be sweet. Well, by early afternoon, the coup was over. It had failed. The head of the coup was a general who had not been arrested earlier. His name was Antonio de Spinola. He too was put on a plane and sent to Brazil. And the right-wing officers who tried to stage the coup, it was the Air Force, were also arrested and put away. But immediately, as soon as it was clear that which way the wind was blowing, the streets just filled with people. It was just an ocean of people with banners and singing songs from the October Revolution and Bandeira Rosa and so on. And of course, we got swept up into that completely. The party went on for 3 days, I think. The whole country closed down. The banks were closed. We couldn't afford to eat. We had no escudos. We couldn't get any escudos. But it was quite an experience. It was quite an experience.
Well, go for it, Gwen.
Maybe it's not possible to answer, but I'm just curious, in that time, so close to that time of the overthrow of fascism in Portugal, did you get a sense that the Portuguese were aware of the African contribution to their liberation, that the liberation movements in Africa played such a key role in weakening that fascist regime?
I think I would say yes. I think that is true for part of the population. And the part of that part of the population would be urban, would be somewhat educated, immediately took the opportunity to begin to reshape the country after the fall of fascism. But, you know, a lot of Portugal and the Portuguese population at that time was rural. Illiteracy in Portugal in the 1970s was like 40%. People were locked into a backward state run by the church, together with the fascist regime, neighbored all around by Spain, which was still a fascist regime. General Franco in Spain, the biggest fascist of them all, was still in power. In fact, to get to Portugal at that time, we had to take the train through Spain, and it was quite an experience. And there were heavy guards on the border. People, even a year after when we were in Portugal, many people were fearing that fascist Spain, would intervene politically in Portugal and stop what was happening. So it was always, there was always that element of uncertainty.
Good. Well, look, I remember from your earlier part that you made a quick reference to occupying forces such as what we've seen in Afghanistan. Do you think there's lessons to be drawn from the fact that the Portuguese Empire just crumbled so quickly as it did after 400 or more years?
Well, I think there are. I think it's very instructive to see, to look back at the collapse of Portuguese colonialism, at this time when the Taliban has completely defeated the biggest military superpower in the world and its allies, simply because whichever way we turn and twist it, whatever we read these days of the quote-unquote collapse of Afghanistan, the reality is that the Afghan population experienced 20 years of effectively a foreign occupation. And in the end, what turned out was that foreign occupation relied so heavily on coercion, on allies with violent warlords, corrupt officials, that it completely turned the majority of Afghans against the occupation. Now, it's very ambiguous. We don't know what will happen. We don't know what the Taliban government is going to do. We don't know what difficulties there will be coming down the road. But just a simple reality is that a foreign occupation cannot last. Here in Portugal, it lasted a long time. In Afghanistan, it was a 20-year war. The French had this experience in Vietnam and in Algeria. And it's always the same. Before the Americans got involved in Vietnam, General de Gaulle took President Kennedy aside and said, don't do it. Don't send soldiers. It's a quagmire. You will never get out of it. The French had been defeated in Vietnam and were being dragged into almost a civil war in France over their occupation of Algeria and the liberation war of Algeria. Of course, Kennedy didn't listen. He listened to his military advisors, and the tragedy of what was Vietnam took a long time to play out. So I think that's the one way or another. It may be centuries, it may be decades, or a few years, but the foreign occupation will never prevail.
I think that's a fairly concise summary of the story that we have had for today. Gwen, have you anything else?
No, I just wanted to thank Ule. I always love our touching base with you, Ule. Always fascinating in your own historical roots in Mozambique. Always so enlightening to listen to you talk about it.
It's always a pleasure to be here, guys. I love the show.
What you just heard was an interview that Gwen and Doug did with Ule Gierstad, who was noting and commemorating the passing of Otelo Sayarivo de Carvalho. He was in his 80s, but he had been one of the architects of the military coup in 1974 that overthrew the fascist dictatorship in Portugal that had kept alive the Portuguese colonial system brutally over 500 years. And what were the implications for Africa and for the world, for that matter, of empire and occupation? The next bit that you're going to hear after the station ID and promo is about the COVID apartheid, and it introduces itself. So this is Amandla here at CKUT 90.3 in Montreal. I'm Doug Miller, and we welcome you to stay with us.
Soca in your 514.
Are you a DJ? Do you love soca music? Production Sounds is giving all Montreal DJs an opportunity to showcase their talent on CKUT 90.3 FM. All you gotta do is submit a 1-hour soca mix to be aired on Soca Sessions late Friday nights. Simply email your 1-hour mix as soon as possible to productionsounds@gmail.com.
Listen me, Production Sounds, Production Sounds.
Crazy people.
Gwen, we're back here, and it's what's the story about COVID and vaccine? It's vaccine apartheid. We have denounced it. We've done editorials on it. We've interviewed people about it, starting even as early as March, April, May last year. We were talking with the head of the COVID response efforts of South Africa, a very eminent international doctor, physician, who made it very clear that it's a worldwide phenomena that must be dealt with on a global basis, that you cannot solve it by curing one part of the world. It won't work. Well, Johnson & Johnson has a factory that has been producing a vaccine in South Africa. And we've talked about the abuses of patent law by the big companies. And Johnson & Johnson, because the South Africans were so desperate to get companies in to open up facilities and make capacity building a possibility, they were given a waiver that if there was a demand elsewhere, they would fulfill the demand wherever they wanted. And so we discovered in the Globe and Mail on the 18th of August, Jeffrey York, the Globe and Mail correspondent, indicated that Johnson & Johnson had been secretly shipping massive amounts of doses from South Africa, which is a country in a dire need of the doses. They'd been shipping them to the EU. So that was a crucial element in South Africa's vaccine plan and the African Union's plan to get that even a single shot dose out. And this one that they had developed there was good because it could be just stored in a regular refrigerator and was much, much cheaper than Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna. But to find out that almost all 10 million doses had been shipped out, and what that could have done just in South Africa alone had it been put in the arms of people, just reinforces the absolute criminality of what the drug companies and international capital is capable of doing with no thought of humanity in their hearts at all.
No, it's criminal. Outrageous. It is criminal. It is so unethical. It is driven by market forces and by money, not by public health considerations whatsoever. It just brings us back to this whole, the pharmaceutical industry is a private profit-driven industry, when we're talking about people's lives, this is the logical outcome of that. And now we're seeing the United States floating, or perhaps even has moved past floating, the idea that everybody's going to get a third shot in that country before most of the people in the world have even gotten their first shot. It just goes from bad to worse, Doug.
Well, and you know, when even in India, where they are also producing the drug, they too are being obliged to send lots of it out of the country. But there are 4,000 deaths per day in the month of June in India, 15,000 globally. And when drug companies with this kind of unmitigated power, uncontrolled power, worse than that, our governments gave them that power. We have allowed our governments to produce this horrendous atrocity. Anyway, there was in June a vaccine summit that brought together very interesting groups of people. Democracy Now! Had a special report on it. And the former health minister, Canavinsa Vansa Mafla of Ecuador, very articulate in English, no problem there, really speaks out clearly on this. And Achal Prabhala from the coordinator of Access IBSA project for access to medications in India spoke as well. And while it's not a focus on Africa per se, but Africa is on just without any indication, any other indication, a focus, because the poorest countries of the world are sitting on the African continent, and they're the ones that are getting the least attention out of all of this. So we'll play it and be back to you after. Thank you.
Thanks.
The Emergency Summit for Vaccine Internationalism was held virtually around the world this weekend. We're joined by the summit's co-chair, Canavinsa Mafla. She is the former health minister of Ecuador, joining us from New Orleans. Also with us from Bangalore, India, is Achal Prabhala, coordinator of the Access IBSA project, which campaigns for access to medicines in India, Brazil, and South Africa. He took part in the summit and has a new article in The Atlantic, co-authored with Chelsea Clinton, headlined, "The Vaccine Donations Are Not Enough." We welcome you both to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Canavinsa, let's start with you. Talk about the significance of this meeting globally, virtually, and what your demand. Your first speaker in one of the promos for this started by saying, gasping for air.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's been a really amazing opportunity to hold this summit with the Organization of Progressive International and have countries like Cuba, Mexico, Argentina, having their Venezuela, having their government, their national government representatives at the summit. And what we're looking for is an alternative to a system that has basically allowed for COVID-19 vaccines to be absolutely concentrated in the higher income countries. You mentioned, for instance, the G7 commitment to donating 600 million vaccines. Well, let's just think about the population in lower income and lower middle income countries. That's at roughly 3.5 billion people. So if we're talking about a vaccine that requires two doses, we're talking about 7 billion doses. We are far, obviously, the commitment by the G7 is far from what we need in lower income and lower middle income countries. So what the summit was proposing and is proposing is the creation of this platform where we have the potential, great potential already in global South countries like Cuba, Argentina, Mexico, that are producing or are developing vaccine candidates that are, you know, close to the possibility of having a mass manufacture. So we saw yesterday Cuba shared to the world data in terms of the efficacy of their vaccine, Soberana 2, which is 62%. This is above WHO standards. So this is really positive, good news, because what the commitments were in that occurred in this summit included having, you know, being open to mass production in other countries from countries that have developed vaccine candidates, but also having pricing that is based on solidarity. We have seen not only the concentration, the hoarding of vaccines in the global north, many times against WTO rules. We saw it at the beginning of the pandemic as well with other types of equipment like masks. But we have seen, you know, in this example, in other examples in the region and in the world, that the profit margin that is being sought by Big Pharma is huge. So this commitment to have pricing that is based on solidarity, pricing that is based on the possibility of expanding access to the vaccine in the global south, is a very positive thing, as well as supporting initiatives that are historically important as well, as the TRIPS waiver that is being considered in the WTO, although we all know there are countries that are dragging their feet. We have the example, for instance, of Canada, where Bolivia has an agreement with a Canadian-based pharmaceutical company to produce vaccine, and Canada has not given the compulsory licensing required to be able to do this. So we see countries that are dragging their feet when we have in front of us practical solutions that could resolve this horrible inequity that we're seeing globally.
I wanted to also go to Achal Prabhula, speaking to us from India, also so tragically hard hit during this pandemic. Some might say criminally hard hit. You begin your piece in The Atlantic that you co-authored with Chelsea Clinton by pointing out developing countries now account for the vast majority of daily global COVID deaths. 85% of the vaccines are going to the richest countries, 0.3% to the poor countries. Scores of countries, almost 100, have not seen a vaccine. That death toll, do you attribute it entirely to vaccinations and the lack of them?
What's happening right now, what's been happening since May, is that the pandemic has mutated. What was once a global calamity is now largely a developing country problem. So there are many ways of measuring the effect of the pandemic. And the starkest way to measure it is through mortality, the number of people who die. And since last month, the number of people who die on a daily basis from the pandemic, are in developing countries. They're in low and middle income countries. In the poorest countries in the world, they now form a share of 43% of all deaths worldwide. In middle-income countries, it's 42%. In the richest countries, it's only 15%. The reason that the richest countries in the world can open their economies, can think of things like making holiday plans across each other as long as people are vaccinated, is because they're vaccinated. Vaccinations are a protection against things that we saw occur in India over the last 2 months, which is deaths that were caused as a result of a failing public health system. Our public health system simply isn't capable of treating people in this country. It's never been. And vaccinations prevent people from dying, you could say unnecessarily, but through the symptoms of COVID that could be treated but are not. Things like access to oxygen, a basic course of steroids, or basic hospital care, which is what the majority of the deaths in India occurred as a result of. Now, the problem with the rate of deployment of vaccines is now well known. We are in a state of vaccine apartheid, and there couldn't be a greater contrast between the inaction from the G7. And let's be clear, donations are great. Donations are especially great to organizations like the African Union, which represent among the largest number of poor countries in this world, and especially great if they can be sent right now and deployed immediately, because there is an immediate crisis and immediate donations respond to that. The G7 announcement fell short on a couple of counts. One, the number of vaccines was inflated. And two, many of those vaccines that have been promised by G7 countries will only come to these poor countries at the end of this year or at the beginning of next year. Now, keep in mind that on a daily basis last month, on average, we had over 4,000 deaths in India alone, 15,000 deaths a day globally. When you consider numbers like that, you know, a day's delay, a week's delay, a month's delay, a year's delay is almost criminal. And there could not have been a greater contrast between what the G7 displayed last week and what some of the poorest countries in the world, as well as other countries who are by far outside the bloc of the richest countries on Earth, got together to decide. I'm sure Karina feels this way as well. She and I moderated and chaired a session with a few leaders of states who were all in solidarity. They were in empathy. It was like going out and speaking a language that suddenly everybody understood. They understood that they were going to do everything they could to help crises in their own countries and to help anyone else in any other country that needed their help. So we had commitments of making vaccines from Cuba available to absolutely anybody who wanted to produce them anywhere in the world, including something called Mambisa, which is a nasal spray vaccine, which has great promise. We had commitments from Mexico and Argentina to share the regulatory authority that they have to assess drugs and vaccines. This is something they've already been doing in the region, and they extended this service to absolutely any country in the world who wished to take it up. We had countries like Bolivia and Venezuela who were in talking about their own acts of civil disobedience that they encouraged others to follow them on to create collective action around this global regime of pharmaceutical monopolies. There was an almost spiritual spirit at this conference, which I must say was a breath of fresh air to have a bunch of countries with power, with real assets to commit in this pandemic, be willing to do that, be willing to do that in a way that we could all share in what each other has to survive this pandemic individually and collectively.
I wanted to ask Karina Vance if you could talk about one of the major themes of this emergency international vaccine summit, being health sovereignty in the global south. What exactly does that look like? And you, really a person of two countries, you were educated here in the United States, you were the health minister under President Correa in Ecuador, and of course lived there as well. What you see people in the United States not understanding about this pandemic when it comes to if one person is sick anywhere in the world, we are all susceptible.
Well, it's exactly that. No, I think that a lot of people in the United States, for instance, consider themselves lucky to have been able to access the vaccine, given what is going on in the global south. It's not a matter of luck, and that is that we're very clear on that. And that's why it's so important to strengthen health sovereignty in the region. What does that mean? That means increasing our capacity to develop vaccine candidates and medications. We have a lot of neglected diseases in the global south, in the Latin American region, that have that, you know, don't have the interest of big pharma because they don't represent enough of a profit margin of profit. So we need to strengthen our own capacity, and we have such great examples of that. Cuba, with five vaccine candidates, despite the criminal unilateral sanctions by the United States, so difficulty in terms of accessing, for instance, raw materials, difficulty in terms of establishing commercial contracts with other countries around the world because of these sanctions. Just a few days ago, we learned about the fact that Venezuela had paid the last payment for the COVAX mechanism to access vaccine, and this last payment was frozen. So they are not yet able to access a mechanism that was created in supposedly to assist countries in developing countries to access the vaccine. So health sovereignty means strengthening our capacity to develop, to innovate, to investigate, to research, and to produce vaccines and the other types of health technologies that we need. And this must be coupled with health system strengthening. We have a great history of this and recent history of strengthening health systems in Latin America and the global south. Much more needs to happen because we have a counter power. You know, for instance, IMF has agreements with the countries like Ecuador, where I'm from, where, you know, it's impulsing neoliberal policies. For instance, in Ecuador, in 2020, we saw a 10% budget cut in the health sector. You would think that this is ridiculous in the middle of a pandemic, but that's the type of policies that we're seeing in some of the countries. So to have progressive governments coupled with progressive leaderships around the world to say we can and we will strengthen our health sovereignty, our capacity to attend our own needs, because health, we have seen it been used as a weapon. This is only not only a matter of money. You know, a lot of countries have had contracts signed, payments to pharmaceutical companies.
We have to leave it there, but I want to thank you so much for being with us, Corinna Vance and Achal Prabala.
Grandola Villa Morena, terra da fraternidade, o povo é quem mais ordena, dentro de ti ó cidade, dentro de ti ó cidade, o povo é quem mais ordena, terra da fraternidade, Grândola Vila Morena. Em cada esquina um amigo, em cada rosto igualdade, Grândola Vila Morena, terra da fraternidade, terra da fraternidade, Grândola Vila Morena. À sombra de uma azinheira que já não sabia a idade, jurei ter por companheira Grândola a tua vontade, Grândola a tua vontade, jurei ter por companheira à sombra de uma azinheira que já não sabia a idade.
Well, gentlemen, ladies, friends, comrades, that's it for Amandla this week. This bit about the vaccine apartheid really upsets me, makes me angry. We saw this in the 90s and 80s with HIV/AIDS, where money was thrown at it here in Canada and North America and Europe, and Africa was left to its own devices until millions of people began to die, and finally a world fund was set up to try and combat it, and has made a huge difference in people's lives. But it took 10 and 12 years and the deaths of millions of people to get there. This should be making us all unhappy, that the folks in Africa and many other countries that are poor should be condemned to die because they can't sit on the resources that we have deprived them of for so long. So make it an election issue, bring it up, argue, shout, and get unhappy like me. So this is it, ladies and gentlemen. Amandla's over for this week. I'm Doug Miller. I've been here with Gwen and Oli, and thanks to Democracy Now! For letting us play their piece. We'll be back next week, so stay tuned to Jazz Euphoria.
Ça prend une bonne dose de courage et de persévérance pour traverser une pandémie.
Ça prend aussi une bonne dose de patience, de résilience, de confiance, d'optimisme, d'humour et d'amour. Une bonne dose de détermination, d'endurance, d'empathie, de motivation, d'ingéniosité et d'espoir.
Mais surtout, ça prend une deuxième dose de vaccin.
Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
The Association des services de réhabilitation sociale du Québec is filing a class action suit. If you were strip searched between July 13, 2006 and July 1, 2011, if you were in one of the following facilities, Bordeaux, Rivière-des-Prairies, Roberval, Saint-Jérôme, or the male sector of Quebec City, you may be able to be part of this claim. For complete details, go to asrsq.ca/class action. That's asrsq.ca/class action. Claims must be filed before January 16th, 2022.
With the It Pays to Be Vaccinated contest, your COVID-19 vaccination could pay off big time. Every Friday in August, you could win $150,000 and two scholarships of $10,000. Plus, if you've had both shots September 3rd, there's a draw for 16 scholarships of $20,000 and a jackpot of $1 million. Register now for the It Pays to Be Vaccinated contest at quebec.ca/vaccination contest. The sooner you're vaccinated, the faster you can take